2 years before Amelia Earhart was breaking barriers in the world of aviation, there was a Texas woman doing that very thing. But she was forced to leave the country she loved to make her dreams a reality. Because in 1920 America, no one was willing to teach a black woman how to fly. This is the story of the first African-American woman to pilot a plane in America. A woman who used an airplane to promote civil rights and equal rights. This is the legendary story of Bessie Coleman. This is Southern Mysteries.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark or troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight. And I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right. All right.
Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring historical mysteries and legendary figures of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. February is Black History Month in America, a month we set aside to focus on historical contributions that African Americans have made to this country. There has been criticism of this month, people who have said it's just not needed. But in 1976, President Gerald Ford expanded what had been a week-long celebration of Black history in America to a full month. He did this because he said the country needed to seize the opportunity to honor the too often neglected accomplishments of Black Americans in every area of endeavor throughout our history. The story of Bessie Coleman's life is the perfect example of why it's so critical to honor and shine a light on those who have had to fight harder than others in this country for their place in history. Bessie Coleman was the first female American to earn an international pilot license. She accomplished this in 1921. 2 years later, a woman named Amelia Earhart would become the second American woman to do that. Yes, we read about Amelia Earhart in history books, see her photos, and marvel at what she accomplished in her lifetime. And the mystery of what happened to her on her fateful flight in 1937 will always haunt us. But Bessie Coleman's achievements in aviation and in the fight for civil rights have been mostly hidden from the pages of history books. Bessie's life story was overshadowed by racism and segregation in the decades following her feats. So much so that when Bessie's life was cut short in 1926, some newspapers mentioned the accident that led to her death, but only named the white man in the plane with her on the day she died. Rather than the black Cherokee woman who had broken down barriers of race and gender. Bessie Coleman was fearless during an era in which any person of color was banned from learning how to fly in America. But Bessie always told folks that she refused to accept no for an answer. She followed the path that would open new opportunities for her and allow her to pursue her dreams, a path that would lead her to France and eventually back home to the country she loved so very much. Bessie Coleman was born in Atlanta, Texas on January 26, 1892. She was the 12th of 13 children born to her black mother, Susan, and her black and Cherokee father, George. When Bessie was a toddler, the Coleman family moved to Waxahachie, Texas, a small town not far from Dallas. George Coleman hoped for better opportunities in that town. Bessie's father was a carpenter, her mother a domestic, and during the cotton harvest, the family picked cotton to earn extra money. George Coleman bought a quarter acre of land and built a three-room house in Waxahachie, but life in Texas was hard for the Coleman family, hard for any black family. Racism was an open and acceptable part of culture in the South at this time. Bessie Coleman would grow up in an era in which people of color couldn't use the same public facilities as white people. Everything was segregated. And for Bessie's father, there was always the fear of lynching. The year after Bessie was born, a black man had been tortured and lynched not far from their home, burned to death in Paris, Texas. Bessie's father struggled in Texas. As he put it, he found that being Indian and black in Texas was more dangerous than just being a black man. He faced hate that led him to make a difficult decision. In 1901, he left his family behind in Texas. and returned to Indian Territory in Oklahoma. Bessie's mother, Susan, remained in Waxahachie and worked hard to raise her children. All of the children helped make ends meet by picking cotton from late November into December of every year. Bessie was in fields picking cotton when she was just 4 years old. She and her sisters would also help their mom with wash she would take in to earn extra money to provide for the family. From an early age, it was clear that Bessie Coleman had drive and determination that would be her strength in the years to come. Bessie loved to read and learn, and thanks to a traveling library that came through their small Texas town, a few times a year, she was able to read books about faraway places and books that taught her to dream and persevere. And that love of learning led her to not only finish high school in the early 1900s, but also attend college. It's important to know that at this time in American history, college was not a given for anyone, especially for anyone of color. But Bessie Coleman worked hard, taking in extra washing and ironing to earn money to pay for her education at Langston Industrial College in Oklahoma. But Bessie could only afford one semester and was forced to drop out of school. Bessie had a choice: return to Texas or move to the big city of Chicago, where two of her brothers lived. In 1915, Bessie chose Chicago. That choice would be pivotal for her because it was in Chicago Bessie formed her dream of becoming a pilot and met the man who would become her mentor and help her chase her dreams. By 1916, Bessie Coleman was working as a manicurist at the White Sox Barbershop, owned by the trainer of Chicago's American League Baseball Club. Bessie had earned a reputation as the best manicurist among the richest and most prominent people of color in Chicago. She was a talented woman, and she was beautiful. She had charisma, and men felt at ease around her. Plus, she was a gifted conversationalist, which always came in handy in her line of work. At this time, World War I had been raging, and soldiers were returning from the war with all kinds of wild stories of flying and adventures they were experiencing abroad. Those stories sparked Bessie Coleman's interest in flying. Along with her older brother, who had been to war and come home in 1918, to taunt his kid sister with tales of French women who were better than black women because they could fly. It was all in jest, but Bessie took the jokes from her brother and used them as motivation. She vowed that she was going to become a pilot. She just wasn't sure how, because there were only a few American women who had a pilot's license. The ones who did were whites and came from prominent wealthy families who could get flight schools to ease admission policies, admit a female student. But Bessie still tried. She approached many flight schools asking to sign up, but she was turned down time and time again because she was a female woman of color. But Bessie didn't let that deter her. She knew she just had to find another way. In the summer of 1919, hate and prejudice spilled into the city of Chicago, leading to one of the worst race riots in history. Bessie was shaken by what she saw unfold and felt thankful that she and her loved ones survived unharmed. A young black man had been on a homemade raft that drifted into an area of Lake Michigan that was designated to be used only by whites. The young man fell into the water and was stoned by whites, angered that he dared to enter their area. As a result of the violence, the boy drowned. That night, this young man was killed. Violence erupted in Chicago, with blacks and whites fighting in the streets with guns and knives. The fighting lasted into the next day, when a gang of white men drugged blacks off a streetcar and beat them. The violence continued until the National Guard moved in to restore order to the city. By the time the riot was over, 38 people were dead, 537 injured, and over 1,000 people were left homeless. We know the full story of what happened during the race riot because of the Chicago Defender, a weekly paper that had been launched in 1905 by Robert Abbott. At this time, the Chicago Defender was considered the most important paper for African Americans due to Robert Abbott's fearless reporting and campaigning against Jim Crow era violence. The Chicago Defender was important to Bessie Coleman, and editor and publisher Robert Abbott became her hero, a hero who ended up sitting down at Bessie's table for a manicure, and he kept coming back. In time, Bessie Coleman shared her dream with Robert Abbott. She explained that she dreamed of becoming a pilot, but had been turned down by every flight school she had applied to. Abbott wasn't surprised that Bessie had been turned down, but he was intrigued by the idea of a black female pilot. He promised her he would do some investigating and try to find a path forward for her. True to his word, Abbott researched options and learned that the French possessed a kind of aeromania and were more liberal in their attitudes towards women and people of color. He told Bessie of women who had achieved great heights, going back to the age of the hot air balloon in France. Joseph Montgolfier invented the hot air balloon in 1782. By 1784, a 19-year-old French woman named Elizabeth Thiebel became the first woman to go on an untethered balloon flight. On November 10th, 1798, Jean Genevieve LeBrasse became the first woman to fly a hot air balloon solo. Sophie Blanchard, a female balloonist whose exploits became legendary during her night ascents across Europe. In 1810, she celebrated Napoleon's marriage to Marie-Louise by setting off fireworks from her balloon. She also took to the air to drop leaflets over Paris to announce the birth of their son. And she was rewarded for her dedication and enthusiasm for Napoleon when he named her chief air minister of ballooning. In 1909, just 6 years after the Wright brothers' historic flight at Kitty Hawk, a French woman, Baroness Raymonde Delaroche, became the world's first female pilot. And as Robert Abbott explained to Bessie Coleman, the French were not only open and supportive of women in flight, they also welcomed people of color to flight schools. The most notable of the day was Eugene Bullard. Bullard had been born in Columbus, Georgia, and had left home when he was 11 when he witnessed his father barely escaped being lynched. He traveled across the South trying to find his calling, but eventually he knew that he had to try to make a new life for himself. Bullard sailed for Europe and eventually settled in France as a prize fighter. When World War I started in 1914, Bullard enlisted in the French Foreign Legion and rose to the rank of corporal. As an infantryman in combat, Bullard was a decorated war hero. Injured during the war, he was hospitalized in Lyon, where he befriended a French air service officer who promised to help him become an aircraft gunner. Bullard was excited by the idea of fighting the enemy from the air. The officer kept his word, and in time, Bullard was able to attend fighter pilot school, and in 1917, Eugene Bullard became the first black military pilot in history, a historic achievement that was not reported in American newspapers or magazines. Eugene Bullard flew 20 missions, was a well-respected pilot who earned the respect and trust of his comrades. But when America entered the war and took over Allied forces, his home country grounded him and assigned him a non-combat position in the infantry. Grounded in France only because the American military refused to allow a black man to fly. But France had opened the door to women and people of color, and Robert Abbott told Bessie Coleman that this could be the path to her dream. It would mean taking a big risk in a new country, but if she could learn French and save money for flight school, he promised to cover her story in the Chicago Defender and pay for her passage to France. Bessie Coleman vowed she'd do everything Robert Abbott advised her to do. She attended a language school where she learned French and left her job as a manicurist to take a higher-paying job as a manager of a chili parlor. She obtained her passport and applied to French flight schools and was accepted to France's most famous flight school, the Caudron Brothers Aviation School. With the financial backing of Robert Abbott and one of the country's first black millionaires, Bessie withdrew her savings and sailed to Europe on November 20th, 1920, for her 10-month flight course. Bessie Coleman was a dedicated and attentive student at the flight school, where she learned to master tailspins, banking, and looping the loop. Incredible feats, because flight school in 1920 was a challenge. Flight was still in its infancy, and Bessie came face to face with the reality of how fragile aircraft in the 1920s could be. She saw nervous students and those who were hesitant or not cautious enough make critical mistakes and crash. In fact, Bessie Coleman witnessed some of her fellow students die while in training. But each accident she witnessed was her reminder to approach flight with confidence and to pay attention to detail. She refused to let anything stand in the way of her goal and refused to be ruled by fear. Training was tough because flight school in 1920 was a matter of watch, feel, and learn. A pilot would take a student on a flight. The student couldn't see the pilot in front of them in the plane. The engine was so loud, students couldn't hear instruction, which meant flight training was all about Bessie paying attention to what her instructor was doing and holding on to the control in the passenger seat so she could feel the motion and the maneuvers of the pilot. Learning with each flight how to mimic the movements of the pilot until those maneuvers became her own and were mastered. Following months of intense training, Bessie Coleman's dream came true. She became a qualified aviator on June 15, 1921, and received her international pilot's license. She was the first American of any race or gender to be directly awarded credentials to pilot an airplane from the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale. To receive this license in France, you had to demonstrate high skill sets comprised of life-saving maneuvers, including turning off the engine before touching down. This license meant Bessie Coleman could fly in any country in the world. Bessie could have remained in France, perhaps had a very different life, but she was on a mission. She wanted to use her new achievement in flight to advance her race, and to do that, she knew she needed to go home. On Sunday, September 29th, 1921, Bessie Coleman arrived in New York on the ocean liner Manchuria. She had already reached semi-celebrity status in national African-American newspapers, and many reporters from those papers were there to greet Bessie when she returned home. Mainstream American papers ignored Bessie's historic achievements. But she was featured in Aerial Age Weekly on October 17th of 1921, with the paper noting her achievement and her plan to make flights in the country to inspire her race to take up aviation. To make those flights a reality, to inspire women and people of color to follow her into the world of aviation, Bessie Coleman needed to earn money. She needed a job and an airplane. Both were hard to achieve for Bessie in 1921. She was rejected over and over again when she applied for commercial aviation jobs. There were few commercial flight opportunities of the day, and the few openings weren't going to a black person, and they weren't going to a woman. Bessie would later say she felt disheartened, but not shocked by this. She refused to do what some people told her to do. She refused to give up. In May of 1922, Bessie Coleman again crossed the Atlantic to study advanced aviation skills in Germany and France with the famous World War I German ace pilot, Captain Keller. She also trained with Anthony Fokker, the Flying Dutchman, testing piloted planes in the Netherlands. Those world-renowned pilots trusted and respected Bessie Coleman's skills. While working with them, she perfected life-saving maneuvers, and in Germany, she was praised for flying the largest and most awkward aircraft ever flown by a woman. Bessie's hard work and determination paid off. When she returned to New York in August of 1922, she was carrying credentials from the Aero Club of France, along with newsreels and newspaper clippings from European newspapers that portrayed her as foreign royalty. The mainstream press finally caught on to the magic of Bessie Coleman. Her arrival home in New York in 1922 was met not only by members of the black press who had supported her all along, but also mainstream newspapers. The New York Times and the Chicago Tribune sent reporters to welcome Bessie home and featured her, with the New York Times declaring she was designated by leading French and Dutch aviators as one of the best flyers they had seen. September 3rd, 1922 would prove to be an important day in the life and legacy of Bessie Coleman. That was the day Bessie Coleman became the first Black woman to stage a public flight in America, demonstrating her showmanship and her flair. Bessie arrived at Curtis Airfield in Garden City, New Jersey, decked out in her trademark military-style uniform. The Glenn Curtis Airplane Company provided the airplane Bessie would fly that day. A record integrated crowd gathered to see this woman they had been reading about in the newspapers. It was Labor Day, and Bessie organized her flight to be a display of patriotism and a display of honor for her fellow African Americans. The exhibition was dedicated to the segregated 15th Regiment of Infantry. The 15th was the first African American regiment sent to France during World War I. The weather for Bessie's flight was perfect. The sky was clear, the temperature was mild, and the show was special. As the band finished playing the Star Spangled Banner, Bessie arrived at her plane along with her passenger, Captain McVeigh. As Bessie flew that day, she dazzled the crowd with loops and spirals, and she had another surprise. An officer in the Universal Negro Improvement Association of New York parachuted from the wing of Bessie's plane, and the crowd went wild. Bessie Coleman landed, and it was clear the crowd was in love with this aviatrix. Bessie finished her Labor Day exhibition by taking individual passengers up in her plane for a fee of $5. Reporters would write of the exhibition and proclaim that Bessie Coleman was worthy of all the praise she had been getting. The Chicago Defender crowned Bessie Queen Bess, the world's greatest woman flyer. Bessie Coleman was an intelligent, beautiful woman who was well-spoken and never shied away from an opportunity for publicity. Bessie knew if she wanted to get her message to the masses and draw in new fans, she needed the press. And in each interview, she made her mission and her long-term plans clear, telling reporters that she was on a mission to be a leader in aviation in America and to inspire more African Americans to pursue flight. She also wanted to open a flight school that would welcome all Americans, including women and people of color. Bessie told reporters that she planned to speak in front of any audience who would welcome her, churches, schools, theaters, so she could expand interest in flight. She hoped those speaking engagements would also help her earn the money she needed to buy her own plane. Bessie also made it clear in interviews that she wouldn't stand for segregation at any of her air shows. If Bessie Coleman was flying, the crowd had to be racially integrated and allowed to go through the same entrance. This was a bold request to make in the 1920s, but Bessie's star was rising, and she used her popularity to make her message clear and to demand respect for all people, no exceptions. And her demands weren't always met. Oftentimes, exhibition organizers or airfields where she planned to fly would refuse to respect her wishes. She openly mentioned these situations in interviews, explaining that it was part of why she loved to fly. As Bessie pointed out, the air is the only place free from prejudice. On October 12, 1922, Bessie flew her second exhibition, which saw record crowds for an air show. Record crowds because she appealed to both Black and white audiences. As one Bessie biographer noted, white audiences saw her as an attractive Black woman piloting an airplane. Black audiences took pride in her courage as she symbolized hope that the African American community could participate in flight. This meant many new doors were opened for Bessie Coleman. After the Chicago exhibition, Bessie agreed to star in a movie called Shadow and Sunshine. The movie was to be produced by an African-American-owned film company called Seminole. Bessie had been excited to be a part of another venture that could elevate her race. That was until she read the final script for the scene that required her character to dress in tattered clothes, carry a pack on her back, and use a walking stick. Bessie Coleman didn't show up to film the movie. She felt the character she had been asked to play would only serve to perpetuate the negative stereotypes most white people had of Black people at this time. It was a role she just refused to play. Robert Abbott of the Chicago Defender continued to follow and support Bessie Coleman's career. Following her Chicago exhibition, the Chicago Defender billed Bessie Coleman the only race aviatrix in the world. On Sunday, October 15th of 1922, over 2,000 people were on hand at the Checkerboard Airfield in Chicago to see Bessie's third exhibition. Bessie's patriotism was once again on display as she honored an African-American military regiment, the 8th Regiment. Bessie flew a series of four 10-minute flights and put on quite a show that day. During Bessie's third flight of the day, the crowd tensed when it appeared that Bessie had lost control of the plane as she was flying a figure eight. But Bessie was in control the whole time. The maneuver had been planned by her to wow the crowd and show off her skills. The crowd loved it, and so did the press. Bessie's calm under pressure earned her the name Brave Bessie. Brave Bess was in high demand on the exhibition circuit, and she was ready to take on a new and risky challenge. The challenge of returning south to her home state of Texas. She knew she would face a hostile racial climate, but Bessie's mission was to elevate her race, and she wanted to spread aviation fever in the South. She began making inquiries to try to book exhibitions in Texas. Well, Bessie Coleman's fourth exhibition was in Gary, Indiana, sponsored by Reynolds McKenzie, a wealthy African-American realtor. During the exhibition, Bessie met Davis Behnke, the founder of the Airline Pilots Association International. Behnke took on a new role as Bessie Coleman's manager. Bessie was one of the few pilots of her day who could fly surplus World War I Jennies and de Havillands. In the early 1920s, you could buy one of those planes for about $200. They were precarious and dangerous, basically held together with glue and wire. But Bessie had the skills to fly the plane, and in February of 1923, she finally had the money she needed to buy one. With some cash and an agreement to display ads from the clouds for Coast Tire and Rubber Company in Los Angeles, California, Bessie purchased a surplus military Jenny. Bessie Coleman finally had her own plane. Soon after buying the plane, Bessie flew an exhibition in Los Angeles with a crowd of over 10,000 people on hand to see her fly. But moments after takeoff, the plane's motor stalled at 300 feet, and thousands watched as Bessie Coleman's plane nosedived to the ground. Miraculously, Bessie survived, but she was seriously injured with several broken ribs, a broken leg, and multiple lacerations. When a reporter asked Bessie Coleman to comment on the crash and the loss of her plane, Bessie reminded the reporter it wasn't a crash. The plane had malfunctioned. And she told that reporter to tell the world she'd be back just as soon as she could fly again. Bessie Coleman's path back, it wouldn't be an easy one. But Brave Bess wasn't one to give up. Bessie remained hospitalized for almost 3 months. When she was released from the hospital, she stayed in the home of a woman who supported her work and believed in her mission to elevate her race. Bessie did all she could to earn money and continue to educate anyone who would listen. She arranged nightly lectures at the YMCA. She would show her flight films from Europe and the United States. As Bessie continued to recover, she wasn't making money, had no place of her own, no job, no plane. She knew it was time to return to Chicago and figure out her next steps. By June of 1923, Bessie was back in Chicago, where she continued to rest and rebuild her strength, at times relaxing with musicians and actors, including Josephine Baker. The time held meaning for Baker, who would, years later, travel to France, earn her pilot's license in the same place that her friend Bessie Coleman received hers. By the fall of 1923, Bessie was ready to fly again. She scheduled a Labor Day exhibition in Columbus, Ohio, where the local paper, the Columbus Dispatch, gave Bessie a lot of publicity ahead of her event. On Labor Day, Bessie was ready to fly, but faced a rain delay. A As she waited for the rain to end, along with more than 2,000 people who wanted to see her fly that day, she learned that just a few miles down the road, there was an all-day celebration of a different kind. An all-day celebration of the Ku Klux Klan. Due to the weather and challenges of the day, Bessie Coleman didn't fly. When she arrived back home in Chicago, she found letters of support and encouragement from the Ohio governor and the mayor of the city of Columbus. They wanted Bessie to come back, and they wanted to support her. On September 9th, 1923, Queen Bess returned to Columbus and flew her exhibition to the delight of an integrated crowd of over 10,000. Bessie had seen a clear message of hate on the day the KKK scheduled their festival to coincide with her show in Columbus, Ohio. But just days later, she had been met with support. This gave Bessie the push she needed to go south. Bessie's manager, David Benke, disagreed with Bessie when she told him she wanted to take her exhibition to Texas and across the South. He said it was just too hostile a place for her as a black female. But Bessie felt that was the very reason she needed to go, to try to break down barriers. She pointed out that she had experienced racism in both the North and the South, and she was just ready to get back to her Southern roots. She didn't want to live in the past. She wanted to be a leader and help influence change in the South. It was Bessie Coleman's decision to make, a decision that meant the end of her business relationship with her manager. He felt Bessie was ending her career by agreeing to fly in the South, and he felt even more strongly that Bessie could be killed by racists. Bessie and her manager went their separate ways in May of 1925. That month, Bessie Coleman headed back to Texas. She set up an operations base in Houston and planned exhibitions all over the South from her home. While awaiting the date of her first Southern exhibition, Bessie made money by speaking to crowds at theaters and churches where she shared stories of her aerial adventures around the world. The date of Bessie Coleman's first Southern flight exhibition was poignant, and it was intentional on Bessie's part. June 19th of 1925, known as Juneteenth. Juneteenth is still celebrated in the South today and commemorates the June 19th, 1865 announcement of the abolition of slavery in Texas and the emancipation of enslaved African Americans throughout the former Confederate states. President Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation in January of 1863, but it would be 2.5 years before Union troops marched into Texas and the proclamation took effect. 60 years later, brave Bessie Coleman returned to Texas, where Jim Crow laws reminded black men and women that decades may have passed since the Civil War ended, but they were still fighting for complete freedom and fighting for their future. Bessie Coleman refused to be bound to the past and made a statement on Juneteenth of 1925. Bessie's Houston exhibition proved to be exciting as always, and she once again offered private flights in her plane for a small fee. The Houston Informer, the city's leading black newspaper, reported on the courage of Bessie and the courage of black men and women who came to the show to support this woman of color, with the paper writing that this was the first time the colored public of the South had been given the chance to fly. And they noted the inspiration Bessie had been to women, with a majority of the passengers who flew in Bessie's plane on the day of the exhibition being black women. As the Informer put it, Queen Bess left the citizens of Houston with a fever to fly. The summer of 1925 would be the summer Bessie Coleman returned to her Texas hometown of Waxahachie. Two exhibitions had been scheduled, but when Bessie learned that the event organizer was requiring separate entrances for black and white audience members, she told him he could change his mind or she wouldn't be flying. Bessie knew the organizer had invested money that he didn't want to lose, and more than anything, she knew she had to take a stand, even if it meant she didn't make the money she so desperately needed. The organizer asked to speak to Bessie and told her he would honor her request. No segregation at the event. Bessie's exhibitions and speaking engagements in 1925 were successful. She was over the moon when she was able to make a down payment on another plane, another surplus military, Jenny, the same model she had purchased years before. In the spring of 1926, Bessie was invited to perform at the annual celebration of the Negro Welfare League in Jacksonville, Florida. Bessie accepted, but to fly, she needed a plane. As luck would have it, she met a young white man named Edwin Beeman. Edwin was the son and the sole heir of the Beeman Chewing Gum Company. Edwin loved aviation, and he was a big fan of Brave Bessie. Such a big fan that when he heard of the situation, that Bess needed a plane for her performance in Jacksonville, Edwin Beeman paid the final payment on Bessie's Jenny. It wasn't a new plane, but it was new to Bessie, and it meant she could accept more invitations to fly and hopefully move closer toward opening the flight school she had been dreaming of. Bessie's exhibition for the Negro Welfare League was scheduled for May 1st, 1926, in Jacksonville. Ahead of the exhibition, Bessie spent time in the city, speaking at churches and visiting African-American public schools to share about her experiences as a pilot and encourage children to follow in her footsteps. Back in Texas, William Wills, a 24-year-old mechanic and pilot, took off from Dallas Love Field to fly Bessie's Jenny to Jacksonville for her performance. Wills was Bessie's new mechanic and publicity manager, who had been asked to fly with her during exhibitions. A flight that should have taken Wills about 21 hours took him much longer. Wills had scheduled 3 stops, but engine trouble forced him to make 2 additional stops before finally landing in Jacksonville. Wills set to work to make final repairs ahead of the exhibition. On April 29th, Bessie Coleman joined her longtime mentor, Robert Abbott, and a few other friends for dinner in Jacksonville. During dinner, Bessie praised Abbott and thanked him for helping her get her start in aviation. The next morning, on April 30th of 1926, Bessie met William Wills at the airfield to go over plans for the exhibition the following day. He made necessary repairs to the engine and said the plane was ready for the show. Bessie wanted to do a test run, and just ahead of the flight, she took a knee and said a prayer. Once in the air, Bessie asked William Wills to take control of the plane. She planned to parachute from the plane on the day of the show, and he would be in control, so she wanted to evaluate each part of the show to make sure everything went as planned. Wills took control, and 10 minutes into the test flight, the plane went into a nosedive. From 3,000 feet to 2,000 feet, at which time the plane flipped over. Bessie Coleman was only 5'3" tall. To better see the field below, she had unfastened her safety belt to stand up and look over the side of the plane. Tragically, it was at that moment the plane flipped and went into the dive. Bessie Coleman was thrown out and fell to her death. William Wills tried to regain control of the plane, but was killed when the plane hit the ground. An investigation would later determine that a loose wrench had jammed the plane's controls. Bessie's planned Jacksonville exhibition had been expected to draw thousands of people. Instead, 5,000 people attended 2 memorial services for 34-year-old Queen Bess in Jacksonville, Florida. Bessie Coleman's coffin was then put on a train to Orlando for another memorial, and then on to Chicago. As Bessie's body was being raised into the baggage car in Orlando, Florida, for the train ride back to Chicago, more than 500 people gathered and softly sang one of Bessie Coleman's all-time favorite songs, "My Country, 'Tis of Thee." Bessie Coleman's love of country was evident in her exhibitions, evident in her dreams of equality, and evident at her final memorial and her funeral in Chicago. A United States flag was draped over Bessie Coleman's casket. She was given a military escort from 6 uniformed pallbearers, all overseas veterans of the African American 8th Infantry. Investigative journalist and early civil rights leader Ida B. Wells served as mistress of ceremonies at Bessie's funeral, where more than 10,000 people gathered to pay their final respects. In 1931, a group of African-American pilots established a tradition that continues today, an annual flyover of Bessie Coleman's grave to honor and remember Queen Bess. Bessie was never able to fulfill her dream of opening a flying school for African-Americans and women, but a black pilot named Lieutenant William J. Powell honored Bessie and saw that her dream became reality when he established the Bessie Coleman Aero Club in Los Angeles in 1929. Powell had served in a segregated unit during World War I and tirelessly promoted the cause of black aviation. More and more clubs opened across the country, and on Labor Day 1931, the flying clubs made history when they sponsored the first all-black air show in America. More than 15,000 spectators were on hand to see the show that day. Bessie Coleman's career was short-lived, and she may not be the first name that comes to mind when you think of women and flight, but she should be. Bessie Coleman was an American legend, a legend who had an impact on the world of aviation long after her untimely death in 1926. Bessie's accomplishments led to America's first African-American flight school opening in Chicago in 1929. About 40% of the famed Tuskegee Airmen first learned to fly at that school. In the 1980s, Mae Jemison, the first black female astronaut in the world, was so moved by Bessie's accomplishments, she shared of her, "I point to Bessie Coleman and say without hesitation that here is a woman, a being, who exemplifies and serves as a model to all humanity, the very definition of strength, dignity, courage, integrity, and beauty." In 2001, Bessie's home state of Texas finally recognized her with a monument in the town of Waxahachie, where she grew up. And Bessie did receive a national honor in 1992. When the U.S. Postal Service issued a stamp commemorating her achievements, noting, "Years after her death, she continues to have a positive influence on millions of young people, and in doing so, has achieved the status of an American legend." Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. Gigi Coleman is the great-niece of Bessie Coleman. Gigi passionately worked to inform the world about Bessie's achievements in the field of aviation, ensuring her name will never be forgotten. Gigi Coleman portrays the story of Bessie in a one-woman show, challenging people of all ages to achieve their dreams in the fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. You can learn more about Gigi's work, her one-woman show, keeping her great aunt's legacy alive, and learn more about Bessie and this episode at southernmysteries.com. There you can catch up on previous episodes, including episode 32, which tells the incredible story of another person you should get to know during this Black History Month, Robert Smalls. Southern Mysteries is available on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, and anywhere you listen to your favorite shows. So make sure you subscribe and never miss a new episode. Thanks for listening.